friends and they're dear to you. I don't know, whomever who is dear to you. When you just come to the point where you think of their loss, you know, you haven't lost them. You just think of them one day not being there. This thing would just itch you from the inside.
And let me add another thing. I think sometimes the pure happiness is not something that will satisfy you.
No.
Sometimes you need a bitter happiness.
Exactly.
Sometimes you need sorrow to be happy. And the thing I'm going to tell you is that there are times in our lives that, I don't know, something really bad happens. It was a kind of test, a challenge, a new thing, an obstacle, whatever it is, I faced it. And moving on after this disaster is something that will give you, I think, the true happiness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I understand.
And this, I think this paradoxical content in every part of everybody's life exists.
So, again, what we are saying right in here doesn't mean that we shouldn't be grateful to whatever blessing Allah has given us. Because after all, if you compare yourself to the downtrodden, to those people who do not have half of the facilities, half of the blessings that you have, then you would understand how fortunate person you have been, no matter how many things, there are many things that you might think that you lack in your life, but even with the existence of those things, still you are more fortunate than many people.
Yeah.
So this doesn't mean that we shouldn't be grateful, doesn't mean that we shouldn't go forward, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be active, we shouldn't work hard. It just means that please don't be so silly. Don't just laugh at yourself. Don't mock yourself. Life has never been meant to be a happy thing, because after all, there would be this bitter taste of loss that would happen to every single one of us.
And I see some people that they divide themselves from life, you know?
And yeah, they get detached from life.
Exactly. And they are like, I don't know, I'm an individual who, I don't know, there is a store written for me. I cannot do anything.
Mm-hmm.
This is not like that.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to seek happiness if you think it'll make you satisfied.
Yeah.
But happiness is not everything.
So then we can rephrase it like this. If you think there's anything that could make you happy,
go for
that. And it's okay, go for that. You know, as long as you're not hurting anyone, as long as you're not disobeying Allah, it's okay, go for that.
But love the life as a whole thing.
Yeah, as true and real as it is.
I do agree with
that. So don't go for hallucinations, don't go for stories that are just imagination, because the bitter taste of that delusion that is going to happen to you after that is going to be even more bitter than accepting the truth as the way it is.
I have only just one gist. The balance is the key.
Yeah, balance in everything.
Yeah. So thank you, my realistic girl, for being here with me. But unfortunately, it was all the time we had for today's episode.
Yeah.
And I have to thank our dear listeners that followed us up to here. And I just want you to be happy, but appreciate the sad moments of your life.
Embrace your life the way it is.
Yeah. And I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to talk about Iranian Islamic Republic Day, which is a national holiday in Iran, marking the day that the results of the 1979 Islamic Republic referendum were announced, establishing Iran as an Islamic Republic. What does this day represent for Iran and Islam, and what benefits has it brought the Ummah?
A milestone in Iran's history. April 1st, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced three millennia of oppressive monarchy in Iran. Islamic Republic Day is an annual celebration of a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots asked Iranians to vote yes or no to the concept of an Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose yes. Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. The birth of the Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, now replaced with God's name, Allah, a reflection of Iranians' faith. Other changes include mandatory hijab, constitutional protections for religious minorities, democracy, and the implementation of other concepts taken from Sharia. Iran has now become a thriving Islamic democracy in the Muslim world. Surrounded by dictatorships, Iran has spearheaded support for Muslim causes across the globe, helping Muslims overcome severe obstacles in the face of immoral Western sanctions and efforts to promote regime change in Tehran.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Islamic Republic Day, we have two esteemed guests. Sayed Mohsen Abbas is a TV producer, journalist, political commentator, and expert on Iran. He specializes in news, current affairs, cultural, religious, and political interest stories. And Batul Sabaiti is a political analyst and activist who has been on the show several times, and we are very happy to have her back, as always. Welcome to the show, both of you. Now, Mohsen, let me come straight to you on this. Just before we get into the discussion of the Islamic Republic and its constitution, let's just lay it out bare. What was Iran like prior to the 1979 Islamic Revolution?
Well, I think it was pretty Westoxified. The reality is that all of that region was, if not post-colonial, most of the Muslim world, it was suffering from a post-colonial sort of hangover, or they'd been under the boot of one form of imperialism or another. They'd suffered all sorts of, oppression, famines. Goodness knows, Iran itself was the subject of, I think, something like 10 or 11 million people dying as a result of imposed famines by foreign powers. So the fact is that the Iranian establishment under the Shah was a despotic one. It was primarily there to serve the purposes of the Anglo-Zionist empire. Even then, they protected him, they brought him to power, they protected him, they destroyed democracy under Mossadegh, they organized coup d'etats, riled up gangs, and then the system that was imposed was primarily to siphon oil, gas, and all the wealth and resources from Iran to the West, and the Shah duly obliged. The casualties were people in the rural areas. The casualties were people's lack of education, their lack of employment, their disparity on so many social metrics that it's hard to sort of go through them all. And if we did that comparison, which I'm sure we will as the program goes on, you'll see that pre-79 revolutionary Iran and post-79 revolutionary Iran is hugely different in one factor in itself, is that it is economically, culturally, politically, militarily, scientifically far better off today than it was under that period. And the most important thing is it has its independent sovereignty. It's a truly sovereign and independent nation, which isn't under the yoke of either the World Bank or any of the other, if you like, usual money mafia puppet masters that this globe seems to have to deal with now. The fact of the matter is that women's position itself is important to mention. Women weren't even in universities. They weren't even in employment. I mean, now at least you've got maybe 60% employment amongst women. You've got sort of increase of universities. There's actually sort of thousands of universities at which the women participate on an equal basis as well. So many factors that are different from yes. now from then.
We are going to go into detail about what exactly has improved and how Iran has changed so much since 1979. But, Batul, let me bring you in first of all, because I want to ask you about it's astonishing, the fact that so many people overwhelmingly in Iran, I think it was close to like 100%, voted in favour of an Islamic Republic. What were they voting for exactly, and why do you think they were voting basically for Islam in Iran to rule over?
Absolutely. I think if we want to talk about the extraordinary nature of the Islamic Revolution, we first have to put it within the scene of the wider political context. So, of course, at that time, you had the Soviet Union that was in the East, you had capitalism that was in the West. And so, essentially, you had this new identity that was rising on the international scene, and that was the identity of Islam. That was that Islam had now become the real identity and the true determining factor for the people and for the society of Iran. And that was something that was unprecedented, because here, of course, the world acknowledges religion as a system of governance for the individual. But for the Iranian people, that was a way for them to kind of get rid of the shackles that was imposed on them, as Sayyid Mohsen Abbas has mentioned, through Iran that was inherently a client state of the US. And we have to understand the context of this is that the US was emerging as a global superpower and the Soviet Union was crumbling. So for a nation to come and to basically have no external outside support, for that backing to essentially be removed and for that nation to be isolated, but to still go in pursuit of these objectives because they ultimately believed that the principles need to overshadow the nation's interest. And Imam Khomeini's leadership was such that he gave the people agency. He expected the change to come from them. Such that their presence on the streets is what will lead to this change. And ultimately, we see that the Islamic Republic essentially rested on the people approving the system. It is through the system that changes are made, essentially, and progress is achieved if it proves unworkable in any field. And the system also proved that it had the ability to be dynamic and to basically regenerate itself if any problems essentially surfaced. And that was ultimately due to the wisdom of the leadership that continues until today, that has the ability to really absorb the masses. We see that in the trajectory of Iran throughout these decades, actually, we see that those that have been in power have not been the quote-unquote hardliners. You've had more of actually the reformists in power who maybe when it comes to the ideals of the revolution don't support it as much as the West likes to call them the quote-unquote hardliners. Again, that shows you that in Iran, really, there is that space and there is that scope to absorb the reaction of the masses. And ultimately, it is driven by the people.
It's funny, isn't it, that Iran, if you look at Western mainstream media, they claim that, you know, it's oppressive in many ways. It doesn't allow freedom of speech. It doesn't allow freedom of the press. It doesn't allow women's rights. But actually, when you look at the situation, there's much more freedoms in many ways than I think you find here under this current Islamophobic atmosphere that we live in right now. Mohsen, I want to bring you in again because what I want to understand is some specifics. The constitution, I think, that was implemented afterwards, which is based on Islamic teachings, has changed and evolved as the country has evolved. Could you just go into a little bit of detail about what exactly is unique about this Islamic constitution that exists now?
Well, Velayat-e Faqih is really ruled by the jurists. So the jurists in Islamic context basically apply themselves to the science of the Quran and the science of Hadith, using those tools and rationality and reason and other, you know, tools of logic. They come up with laws and rules and regulations for a society to exist. But they are laws and rules which have a common heritage within the people of the book, if you like. So Christians, Jews, I mean, Judeo-Christian original actual principalists will recognize that the virtue ethics on which the Islamic Republic of Iran is based, the virtue ethics of the prophets, the virtue ethics, obviously, of the Prophet Muhammad specifically, are all what drive the laws, the constitution, the policies, the principles, and the general policies of Iran throughout. And if you measured those ethics and that morality against their reality, what you'd find is, if you looked at their foreign policy, for instance, and you measured it. They said that they would support Palestine and the freedom of Palestine. They said that they would support the oppressed against the oppressors. They said that they would, be any kind of threat to their partners and their sort of their neighbours. And you've seen just on that policy, if you were to measure them up, they supported the Palestinians. They've supported the Yemeni oppressed. They've supported the oppressed in Syria. They've stood against Anglo-Zionist imperialism and suffered the worst sanctions that the world has ever seen on a nation. You know, the maximum pressure translates into literally starving and boycotting Iran on every level that you can imagine economically. No country would be able to sustain this had it not had the resistance economy and the will and the spiritual, moral, fortitude. And I think relying on Islam, relying on that spirituality is what's allowed them to weather these storms and come up with solutions, pragmatic solutions. Clearly, there are things that they would like to do. I mean, one of the principal ones is to have no link, if you like, to the usurious economic system of the world and the World Bank and such like entities. They would like to be able to see that, that there's no Anglo-American influence at all in the West. But these things are sort of macro, long-term objectives, which clearly they're not being allowed to implement. And they're under huge military, as well as psychological, cultural attack. Constantly. So you have to measure Iran's entire policy and its value system against the value system that it's up against. The value system it's up against and it's consciously fighting against is one of neoliberalism. It's of rampant imperialism. And I think for Iran to stand stoically by the principles set by its original, its pioneers, and Ayatollah Khomeini in particular, is hugely creditable because they could easily have collapsed into just selling out and buying their way into the global system. They haven't. They've stuck to those principles.
I think that that's a very strong point to end on for the time being as we come away from the discussion. Well, let's come back to the discussion now. Batul, let me bring you in on this again, because you said something earlier on which I appreciated very much. It was the fact that Iran chose Islam and it went its own route, not just, you know, through self-determination, you know, through their own constitution, but the fact that they chose their own political way. They didn't go for the left wing or the right wing based on what other countries are leading, spearheading. They went for their own system, which fell into Islam, the lap of Islam. And also, I think what you mentioned before about it being, it's a democracy. People don't like to admit this, but Iran is a democracy and remains a democracy ever since 1979. Perhaps you could just explain for people who are not aware of this point, how is Iran's a democracy? How does it work?
All right. Essentially, so Iran is based on a democratic theocracy, which basically means that the constitution is Islam. The reason that the constitution is Islam, because as we are alluding to, it's the people who have actually voted for the system to come into place. Now, in order for Iran to be able to protect and to strengthen its nation, there were many different power institutions that were established. And the reality of these power institutions is that they are designed to monitor each other, to not allow for any diversion or abduction by those in power. And the reality of it is that it creates a kind of adhesive relationship between the leadership and the people, because the people feel like they have agency within the system. Because you see that within all of those power dynamics and institutions and within all those elected officials, they are either directly or indirectly elected by the people. So let me give an example. You have the supreme leader in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. He is elected from 88 mujtahids who form the Assembly of Experts. Essentially, these are jurists who the nation of Iran decide on, essentially. They go out and they vote to say that we want these individuals to form as part of the Assembly of Experts. And essentially, not only do they elect the Supreme Leader, but they monitor the Supreme Leader to ensure that actually he is acting within the bounds of the Constitution. So even the Supreme Leader in this regards is not kind of given a free pass. And if we see that, for example, you have also the Islamic Consultative Assembly, which is the Islamic Iranian Parliament, essentially, you have the Guardian Council, which is made up of 12 jurists, fuqaha, who basically ensure that the Islamic Constitution is being followed through any of the laws that are passing through. So what this shows is actually there's a democracy on many levels. It's through through the officials that get elected, and it's also through the fact of honouring the constitution that these people have asked for. The reason the nation of Iran asked for an Islamic constitution is because it realises that in order for real change to happen, Islam cannot be secular. Islam cannot apply just on the personal individual sphere. It has to be in power. But when Islam is in power, that is actually how real change is created. And we see that actually Iran is the only country in the world, I would argue, today that actually says what it says without being afraid. You know, even, for example, if we look at Russia, even if we look at China, they didn't send fuel shipments to Venezuela, for example, when it was under sanctions. But Iran did. Iran, as Sayyid Mohsen Abbas was saying, has complete agency and freedom. And we have to understand that freedom, this aspect of dignity and izzah, is inherent to Islam. Islam says that as an individual, you might as well be dead if you are captive and shackled to entities other than God. So the vision of the Islamic revolution was that only God can tell me how I can live my life and how things should be administered, and no other external power. And this essentially has to happen through the people. That's a prerequisite. And that's why I would argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran today is a real Islamic governance, because despite the so-called dynasties that have existed, you know, after the advent of the governance of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in Medina, all of them have used Islam as a cover for their interests. You know, whether it's Banu Umayyah, Banu Abbas, all the way one can argue to the Ottoman Empire, to Saudi Arabia today. But when you have a nation in which its principles overshadow its nation's interests and it is fearless in the pursuit of social justice, then you know it's based on something substantial.
For sure. And Sayyid, I want to bring you in again, because you mentioned something earlier on about the fact that, you know, women's rights in Iran have improved fundamentally. Their ability to gain an education has flourished ever since the revolution took place. I think what I take from the revolution is that the lower classes in Iran, the poorer working class people, if you like, they also benefited tremendously from this revolution. I think, again, it falls on the principles of Islam, because Islam says you should help the downtrodden, you should be charitable, you should provide an education for all. And I think that that's a point worth emphasising. It wasn't just women, it wasn't just working class, many people have benefited. Perhaps you could go into more detail.
I think the rural classes are certainly the biggest winners, because they were neglected on a scale which is, you know, actually quite shocking. I mean, the Shah of Iran had no concern for the rural farmers. And actually, Iran is a fundamentally agricultural society, as even today. I mean, it's agricultural. Although water is a problem, some of the economic, the climate change issues are hitting Iran more adversely than other places. But nonetheless, they're still very self-sufficient in that regard because of that rural outfit. But he regarded them as basically peasants who were to be exploited. The old serf kind of autocrat kind of relationship. That changed in 1979, clearly. Education-wise, households themselves, in terms of having basic amenities like electricity or supply of gas, you know, 85 to 90% of homes have gas and electricity now. These are just little basic things, and the government has intervened to make sure this happens. In terms of employment, of course there are problems because of this maximum pressure business and the hugely problematic kind of global environment in which Iran is subjected to these kind of sanctions. And that has caused some problems in terms of lack of employment. But there, even that, over the last 10 years or so, Iran has found solutions through the resistance economy, through generating its own industries, through developing its own technologies. And the companies that are protected within Iran to be able to develop things for those rural masses and for the urban classes has been fair. I think nobody can argue against that. I think building a civilizational plan which is going to last for the next 40 years or so has been something that Ayatollah Khamenei has been focusing on very much so, and he talks quite often about this. And that dream, the prophetic dream, is manifested in the Khamenei dream, I think, and the Khomeini dream. And it is, first and foremost, to look after the welfare of the people, to look after their needs. That is primary. The second thing is not to be selfish, rather like the imperialist Western neoliberal philosophy, which is, I'm all right, Jack, let's plunder everything, make ourselves happy and nice and fat on the misery of other people around the world. Iran is not doing that. Iran is saying, collaboration, cooperation. This is very Islamic. This is at the heart of it. Of course, issues like charity, these are commonplace. Family is really important and is still being built upon. And all these things rival Agenda 2030, for instance, and the push from the global elitists to actually create a more narcissistic, a more individualistic, a more a broken society, because that suits their control agendas. Mm. Iran is not doing that. Iran is saying family is vital. So you'll go to Iran even today, and one of the most powerful things I note is that maintenance of those kind of natural ties. So I think that the society is healthy. Its only complaint will be the economic one in terms of jobs. I think that's the only legitimate thing, and even that is not entirely, of course, the fault of the government necessarily.
Mostly down to sanctions issues, which are, of course, a cruel Western tactic to try and undermine the Islamic Republic, which has failed essentially until now. Batul, we haven't got long left of the show, so I want to end it on you if I can. I think one thing that Iran has done very well is it's helped other Muslims outside of Iran as well. That's something which I've noticed, and you, I think, recently went to Lebanon and Iraq, so you would see some of the benefits that has come about from the 1979 revolution and so on. Could you just perhaps detail if this is actually the case? Has Muslims across the Ummah benefited as well as Iranians from the Islamic revolution?
Right. So I'd start off by saying that Iran has an open hand policy. So it looks to support anyone who asks for that help, essentially, and are an oppressed people. So this is even outside of the scopes of if we want to talk about the Muslim Ummah. You know, you have examples of South Africa, you have examples of, you know, Venezuela, Cuba, etc., just to name a few. If we want to talk on the military front, for example, you know, the examples of, you know, defeating ISIS get brought up, you know, the role that Haj Qasem Soleimani played in this regard, the support for the Palestinian liberation. But even in Iraq, when Bush the First invaded during the Gulf War, you saw that Iran actually united with those entities that had previously fought Iran within Iraq in order to basically focus on the main arch enemy, and that is to get rid of the American occupation. So even in this regards, Iran has demonstrated that actually it possesses many characteristics which has enabled it to not only sustain itself, but to grow stronger and stronger. So for example, the aspect of being patient, the aspect of not allowing the enemy to drag them into the square that they want them to get dragged into. Mm. They don't react emotionally, right? They react on the on the basis of principles. So they can, for example, distinguish between the primary enemy and the secondary enemy, for example. In other regards, you know, for example, it has set up the Shaheed Foundation, you know, that supports the families of martyred individuals within Iraq. You have within Nigeria as well, through the Islamic movement of Nigeria headed by Sheikh Ibrahim Segzaki. You have the support through the creation of infrastructure, electricity in Iraq, that the Islamic Republic has been very much involved in. So it's not only in the military sphere, but I think the most important thing is that what the Islamic Republic has done is it's set a model for the rest of the countries in the region. It set a model for Lebanon. It set a model for Yemen. It set a model for Iraq. It set a model even for Pakistan, for Afghanistan. When we look at all these paramilitary organizations that have emerged that are basically fighting against the hegemonic powers in the pursuit for freedom, that is all inspired from the principles of the Islamic Revolution. And that's something that the leaders of those movements themselves would tell you.
Well, thank you to both of you for your comments today. It's been very enlightening, but unfortunately we are out of time. That is all the time we have, unfortunately. But don't worry, we will be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Thank you to everyone at home. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The head of the International Monetary Fund has warned that the global economy faces risks to its financial stability because of the turbulence in the banking sector. IMF head has said interest rate hikes to battle inflation have created stresses and vulnerabilities. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the global economy faces a difficult year as the fallout from the recent banking crisis and the formation of rival economic blocs triggered by Russia-Ukraine crisis threaten to undermine global economic stability. That's according to the head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, who was speaking at the China Development Forum in Beijing recently. According to Georgieva, 2023 will be challenging and is likely to see global growth slowing to below 3% as scarring from the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and monetary tightening weigh on economic activity. Uncertainties are exceptionally high, including because of risks of geoeconomic fragmentation, which could mean a world split into rival economic blocs, a dangerous division that would leave everyone poorer and less secure. Together, these factors mean that the outlook for the global economy over the medium term is likely to remain weak, she warned. Georgieva also noted that the recent troubles in the banking sector, from the collapse of several lenders in the U.S. to the near insolvency of Switzerland's second largest bank, Credit Suisse, expose vulnerabilities in the global financial system, which will need to be addressed as the year progresses. Risks to financial stability have increased. At a time of higher debt levels, the rapid transition from a prolonged period of low interest rates to much higher rates necessary to fight inflation inevitably generates stresses and vulnerabilities, as evidenced by recent developments in the banking sector in some advanced economies. Georgieva praised the recent efforts of policymakers to support the global banking system by enhancing the provision of U.S. dollar liquidity, saying they have acted decisively in response to financial stability risks. She noted, however, that the measures have only eased market stress to some extent, but uncertainty is high, which underscores the need for vigilance. Georgieva noted, however, that the outlook for the global economy is not all bad. We can see some green shoots, including in China. Here, the economy is seeing a strong rebound, and the IMF's January forecast puts GDP growth at 5.2% this year. Driving this growth is the anticipated rebound of private consumption as the economy has reopened and activity has normalized, she stated. The IMF head added that China is set to account for around one-third of global growth in 2023, which would give a welcome lift to the world economy. And beyond the direct contribution to global growth, our analysis shows that a 1% increase in GDP growth in China leads to 0.3% increase in growth in other Asian economies. On average, a welcome boost. Also, Guardian noted IMF head's stark comments came as the European Central Bank ECB said the recent turmoil in banking would have a real-world impact on business and growth. The EU Central Bank fears problems in the banking sector will result in lower growth and dampen inflation, ECB Vice President Luis do Guindos said in an interview with Business Post. He said, "Our impression is that they will lead to an additional tightening of credit standards in the euro area, and perhaps this will feed through to the economy in terms of lower growth and lower inflation." The outlook for the UK after Brexit is also presenting a challenging trade-off between low growth and high inflation, putting central bankers in a tricky position when it comes to increasing interest rates. The head of Britain's public spending watchdog underlined the negative impact of leaving the EU for the UK economy, saying it would cause economic scars even deeper than the pandemic. "We think that in the long run, Brexit reduces our overall output by around 4% compared to had we remained in the EU," Richard Hugh, the chair of the Office for Budget Responsibility, told the British outlet, adding, "It's a shock to the UK economy of the order of magnitude to other shocks that we have seen from the pandemic, from the energy crisis." Guindos said that as economic stress increased in the UK, EU and the US, so-called shadow banks, a term for non-bank financial institutions, could further expose cracks in the financial system. "We do believe it could be a source of problems for the whole financial system, and we need to be careful," he said. These non-banks, which are outside the supervision powers of central banks such as the ECB, had taken a lot of risks during the times of very low interest rates, and all while growing as share of the financial system in Europe, Guindos continued. Regulators in Switzerland continue to grapple with the fallout from the collapse of the Credit Suisse. Public pressure has mounted on regulators after a vast package of support for the bank before its emergency merger with fellow Swiss bank UBS. The controversies over the bailouts have added to echoes of the global financial crisis caused by the recent toppling of major financial institutions in the US and Switzerland. The Swiss financial regulator said it was still open to taking disciplinary action against managers at Credit Suisse. However, it was a lower priority than preserving financial stability by overseeing the marriage between Switzerland's second largest lender and UBS, said FINMA's head, Professor Marlin Amstad.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer your questions, queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Well, parenting or child rearing promotes and supports the physical, emotional, social, spiritual and intellectual development of a child from infancy to his adulthood. And the same relationship could actually go up somewhere and it could go down. Sometimes it can actually be supporting and sometimes it can be distorting. Now, today in our studio, we have with us a guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, you have been talking with us for quite a while now that what are the different key points that help a parent-child relationship to become better? And you said it should be truthfulness not only in the speech but also in the actions and also expression of love, which is very, very important to make this parent-child relationship a better one. What is the third point that you want to discuss?
As I said, we start off with being truthful, and the truthful expression of love is important. If loving a person, without loving a person, you cannot change him. You can't expect to change him, because the important thing is that we want you want him to change, you want her to change. So you need to love him for that. Your child or he does not realize that you are doing so because you love him, and he feels or she feels rejected, or he will not accept anything from you. And then thirdly, which is much more important apparently, is that you need to empathize with them, not sympathize. Sympathies are important. So the difference between sympathizing
and empathizing,
what is the difference? The difference is when you sympathize with a person, you say, oh, he feels, if I give him some medicine and he won't like it, you, out of your sympathy, especially mothers, they can't bear the child being, you know, pricked with a needle and say, oh, let him, don't take him. There's no need to give him this injection. He will cry and I will not be able to bear it. And I'm so that's maybe sympathizing. But the empathy is, no, you empathize with him. You feel how he feels. And you feel that, look, you make yourself understand that you need to be in his place or in her place and to do what is important for him or what is important for her. That's empathizing.
As Bill Bullard puts it, that the highest form of knowledge is empathy. So even if you're expressing your form of knowledge in any other way, you could actually express it in a better way in the form of empathy.
Exactly. So empathizing is putting yourself in the other person's place, and before he or she even expresses something,
you understand
that you understand and you take a lead in resolving the problem of a person. That is a very important thing that we need to realize. The Holy Prophet is described in the Holy Quran to be the person who is azizun alayhi ma'anittum.
All right.
It is important. It is very grave for the Holy Prophet what happens upon you, for you as your his followers. O you mu'mineen, raufun bil mu'mineen. He has love for you, and he feels very much concerned with which is whatever befalls you, whatever you are stricken with. He realizes that. He empathizes with you, and he comes up with a solution before you can even understand and realize it. So therefore, we need to empathize with our with.
So sometimes we could actually use the same prophetic stories if we want to teach with our words, with our speech. So this is the best form of the things you're teaching through speech, that you're actually recalling with your children, with your teens, the stories of Prophet wherein they have been empathetic towards others.
Exactly. Empathizing with others, especially your children, to make them, you feel that you feel for them because you know what they're going through. The problem is that nowadays our parents even don't realize what children are going through. A child, especially in adolescence, at the age of adolescence, is going through so much of a change.
Stress,
and transformation
changes.
And change.
Yeah.
When we were at that age, we also went through that, but we have forgotten that.
Yeah.
We have, most of us have forgotten what befell us.
Yeah.
We don't remember that, and we can't therefore empathize.
But so, everything has some of the impact that remains with you in your adulthood. We'll talk more with We'll talk more with you on this topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Naqvi, and we are discussing empathy as a key point to develop a better parent-child relationship. Professor, you said that empathy is very, very important if it's in speech, and you should, the best form is that you go on telling the prophetic stories to your teens, to your children, and at the same time, you were giving us more explanation.
So we need to, number one, be able to foresee or forecast or see what problems a child can face in his life or in her life. In everyday issues, you need to be there for him. You need to be there for her, whether it is going through schooling or going through other stages in their lives. In their, especially their adolescence, you need to be able to understand and to realize and to visualize that stage. And before,
so the first problem, according to you, here with the parents today, is that we really don't know what the child is going through, especially the teenager. What a child is going through, and because when there comes a teenage, and then this child feels like there's some generation gap within me and my parents, and then he starts hiding quite a few things, or maybe the behavior in the family has been in a way that a child, he actually prefers to keep things hidden from his parents.
Yes, he or she may feel embarrassed by the fact that if he or she wants to relate something to his father or his mother, he can't do so. Because he feels that his parents can't even understand, or they cannot feel for him.
Well, Professor, there's very important point that you discussed here, that embarrassment. This is because of embarrassment sometimes that a teenager hides things from his parents wherein he needs empathy. But at some of the points, it's because I have been actually interacting with a couple of teenagers, and who come up and say that we don't share things with our parents, or we don't want their empathy, because rather than being empathetic to us, they start behaving like a police. All right, now if this is a problem, you were not supposed to do this. You were not supposed to do this. So they start lecturing. So don't you think parents go wrong over here?
And that is the problem, because the parents feel that instead of feeling for their children, they start feeling bad about themselves, because they start thinking, look, if my child has done this wrong thing, if my other family members or my neighbors find out about this, then it will be an embarrassing situation for me. So they start becoming worried about their own status,
yeah,
and the social problems that they may face in the society. So again, they're not empathizing with their child, they're empathizing with themselves. So that is the problem normally. When, for example, you find a child who needs to get married and his parents are not getting him married, he goes off with a girl goes off with a boy goes off with a girl, and they get, into a situation. And then the parents can't accept that.
Yeah.
They were the cause of that. They did not realize that this child or this girl needs to get married.
Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned. Ya muqiy al-khayrat,
ya muqiy al-khayrat. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Lakhvi with us in the studio, and we are discussing empathy as a key point to develop a better parent-child relationship. Professor, you were saying that so many teenagers who feel like just fleeing from the home, or sometimes the situations go worse, they feel like much worse things than that, and that's because of lack of empathy. And why that empathy does not exist? You said that sometimes parents feel like they are empathetic towards their children, but they are actually empathy. They express empathy towards themselves only, not for their children.
So they feel bad about themselves. They feel badder. They feel bad about their children, but they feel more, they feel worse about themselves because they feel they will lose their distinguished position they may have in society. Now the problem is they should preempt that. This should be preemption. For example, nowadays, especially in the age of social media, in the age of the internet, the problem is many of our parents do not know what's happening in the internet. Yeah. Many of our parents do not keep abreast with what's happening today in the social media. And of course, they consider it maybe they don't have time for it, or it is something new. They are not aware of it. They are old. They belong to the older generation of people who didn't know much about social media. Or, for example, they don't know. They feel it is off limits. Maybe there are things which they do not want to see. They cannot see because really it is prohibited. But their children are being exposed to it, so they should know what's happening. And they need to preempt that. Now, stopping and limiting things is important. Yes, for example, we have the YouTube for kids, maybe, or YouTube or Netflix for kids. That's good. Or other, for example, ways to limit the exposure that our children have. There should be ways to limit that. There should be ways to provide alternatives. So the important thing is that if we want our children to be, you know, protected from the harms of these things which are going around themselves.
Parents also need to educate themselves.
Parents do need to know what's happening. They need to know how to preempt it. They need to know how to protect their children.
Yeah.
And that is learning that they have to do. And sometimes we don't have that learning. So if we need to empathize with our children, we need to know what they're facing, what they are going through. So they need to keep a watchful eye. It shouldn't be in such a way that the child feels that he is being, you know, imposed upon, or there's a person always watching upon me. There should be some subtle ways of being able to monitor what's happening.
Right.
But the parents today need to be much more clever than before.
Yeah, so because the time is changing at a very fast pace that we can even imagine. Well, to conclude, it is just we have to be empathetic. We have to be simply listening. We have to hold the space, and we have to withhold our judgments. And we also have to be giving the message to our children that you're not alone. We are with you. Well, thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. Thank you. IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.